Today on Against the Grain, Hurricanes Katrina, Harvey, and Maria have been recent reminders of the power of massive storms to not only inundate cities and change landscapes, but to reshape or reinforce existing class and racial divisions. Historian Stuart Schwartz reflects on 5 centuries of hurricanes and conflict in the Greater Caribbean, including the Southern United States. And Dale Jamieson reflects on inertia in the face of global warming. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. As Hurricane Laura bears down on Texas and California battles mega fires, most scientists believe more ferocious hurricanes, as well as intense wildfires, are only going to increase with global warming. Yet we know that the ways that societies respond to so-called natural disasters vary widely, and that the divisions within any society along lines of class and race become particularly pronounced during crises like storms. After Sandy, within relatively short order, Wall Street had power restored, whereas the poorer areas of the New York metropolitan region and the northeastern seaboard were left to languish without electricity. In Sea of Storms, the history of hurricanes in the Greater Caribbean, from Columbus to Katrina, Stuart Schwartz traces hurricanes and class and racial conflict in the region stretching from the south of the United States to South America. Later in the program, we'll turn to Dale Jamieson on why little was done to stop global warming, but we start with Schwartz, who's professor of history at Yale University. When I spoke with him, I began by asking him, why look at the Greater Caribbean as a whole? Why see it as a broad region sharing some kind of unity?
I think that by taking the Caribbean as a whole, which including the southeastern United States, it gives us a better idea, because hurricanes don't recognize national differences. And so they're really a wonderful way to think about a kind of transnational history, a history that puts individual nations in a broader context. And this kind of circum-Caribbean region is a region that's characterized by a number of things: a history of colonialism, the settlement of the Americas, the participation of the English, the French, the Spanish, the Dutch, the Danes, the role of slavery in all of these societies around the Caribbean, and the subsequent problems of having to do with race. All of those are elements that are transnational. And if you look at simply the national histories, it sometimes gives you a somewhat biased and closed view of the process of the history. And in that sense, the hurricanes are interesting because they're a phenomenon peculiarly of this region, at least in the Atlantic world. And as a result, they're a good phenomenon to which kind of the disasters reveal the kind of facets of a society. And so the hurricanes in the book aren't the protagonists of the book. They're really the initiators of the story. And the story is really how societies and governments respond to these recurring natural disasters.
Given that you say that the hurricanes are not the focus in and of themselves, but the way that people relate to them, is there any danger in organizing ideas around this notion that the environment might determine the actions of the people in societies through time?
This is always, of course, a problem whenever you're dealing with the environment or with topography or with climate in general, of becoming an environmental determinist. And that's something I try very hard to stay away from. It seems to me that the natural phenomenon, the hurricanes in and of themselves, they don't determine the story. They simply initiate the story. And the story is determined by what we do before and after the event. But it's a fair question, because you don't want to think that everything is determined by the environment. You know, back when I was a high school student, a very popular historian, was Arnold Toynbee. And Arnold Toynbee wrote a multi-volume history of world civilizations, in which he thought that all civilization had to take place in the temperate zone, which of course is where he was from.
Of course.
He was English. But he thought that that was the case because, if it was, too cold, people would be so busy struggling to survive that they didn't have time to make civilization. And if it was too warm, Polynesia, well, it was just too easy. You could pick the bananas off the trees, and so you didn't have to worry about making civilization. And it was kind of the Goldilocks theory of societies, you know. Some were too hard and some were too easy, and it just so happened that England was just right. And that's the kind of environmental determinism that historians nowadays struggle valiantly to stay away from.
Well, and of course, the question about how do humans relate to natural disasters gets complicated when one realizes that sometimes this can be a two-way street. I mean, certainly in terms of thinking about hurricanes, although hurricanes obviously were around before humans were producing and sending carbon into the atmosphere, clearly it's hard for us to now think about hurricanes without thinking the human impact on global warming.
Yeah, sure. The global warming story has generated lots of interest now in hurricanes as a kind of demonstration of the effects of global warming. And there's a great debate that goes on amongst the scholars of the environment, the scientists, about whether in fact the frequency of hurricanes or the intensity of hurricanes is being affected by global warming. It's a debate that I talk a bit about in the book, but I'm not a natural scientist, and I have my opinion about it, but my book's not about whether global warming is generating an intensification of hurricanes or not. I think that there's lots of evidence that we are in a period of global warming. The question is whether it's humanly generated or whether it's part of a cyclical story that extends back for millennia. And because our data that we have, the hard data that we have, only really begins around 1850, we really can't say very much about phenomena that go back for millennia because we just don't have the data that would allow us to make a definitive judgment.
Well, your book, Stuart Schwartz, takes the long view, not as long as you were just talking about, not back a millennia, but back five centuries, to look at the interaction of the societies within the Greater Caribbean and hurricanes. And I wonder if you could begin your story by telling us how the indigenous populations of the Americas, obviously this is a very broad question, viewed hurricanes at the time of the onset of the conquest, and how did the storms shape their lives?
Well, all around the Caribbean region, we have evidence that the indigenous peoples learned about the hurricanes and altered their way of living according to that. We know that there were indigenous peoples, for example, in Florida that actually planted trees around the edges of their agriculture to serve as sort of windbreaks because of hurricanes. And we know that the great Maya civilization in Yucatan in Central America, which built great cities, virtually none of their cities were built on the coast, probably indicating their realization that by placing them on the coast would put them in danger from the winds and the accompanying sea swells, the tsunamis that often accompany the hurricanes. And so we have evidence there. In the Caribbean itself, the indigenous peoples tended to grow root crops like what's called yucca, manioc, which is a root crop because it's much less vulnerable to wind damage the way something like corn or maize would be. So there's plenty of evidence from archaeology and from early observers that indigenous peoples knew about the storms and learned how to deal with them. The people that lived in the Caribbean islands themselves originally came from South America, from areas that didn't have hurricanes. So they, in fact, during their experience of settlement of the islands, had to learn about the hurricanes. But they learned relatively well. And when the Europeans arrived, the Europeans soon turned to the indigenous people to tell them about when to expect the hurricane, what signs might reveal that a hurricane was coming, because the Europeans, of course, had no real experience with these kinds of storms.
So when the Europeans settled, and we're talking about the Spaniards conquering the region, how did the experience of hurricanes, and you say that they had to learn from the indigenous people, how did it shape the societies that they began to impose or build in the region?
Well, when the Europeans arrived, they had never seen storms quite like this. There were storms where existed in the Mediterranean and occasionally violent storms occur in Europe. But these kinds of winds were unknown for the most part in Europe. So they turned immediately to their sources, which in the period of the 16th century, they turned to Aristotle, to the classical geographers. There was really nothing in Aristotle. Aristotle wrote a book on meteorology, and they turned to that, and there was nothing there that really guided. Then they turned to the Bible, of course. And there's lots of references to storms in the Bible, but no guide to this. And so they turned to the common practices that they had, the folk practices that they had about how to control violent storms, thunderstorms in Europe. And they turned to the indigenous people. It was a sort of combination. And so Spaniards, for example, often when there was a bad storm in the 15th and 16th century, might fire cannon into the air, hoping that the sound would drive the clouds away. They would ring the church bells, also hoping that the sound would work. Or in case of bad storms, they might bring the host, the Eucharist, out into the fields to drive away the bad storms. Those were the common folk practices that they used. But when they got to the Caribbean, they used those things as well. But they also then turned to the indigenous people, who seemed to have some idea about when the storms were coming. We have a case from as early as 1512 of the Spaniards trying an Indian chieftain as a sorcerer, because he was able to tell them that a storm was coming. They were a little confused about this. It made them wonder. But they, at the same time, they needed that knowledge. And so by the end of Columbus's life, he knew enough about them to be able to predict that a storm was coming. And, in fact, told that to the governor of the island of what's now the Dominican Republic. The governor didn't believe him. The governor's fleet was lost, but Columbus's ship was saved. It's a interesting story of the early perception of the hurricanes as the Europeans began to learn them.
Well, how long did that tension exist between the attempts to predict storms as something that could be predicted and a more kind of religious framework that would see the source of the storms not to do with the weather patterns, but actually to do with the sins that had been committed by those who were about to be on the receiving end?
Well, it actually lasts for a long time. And even today, every time there's a hurricane here in the United States, you'll find somebody online or in a newspaper saying that it's our sins that have caused this to happen, whether it's gay marriage or gambling or whatever the particular sin is. There's somebody will come and say that that's simply a punishment from God for these sins. And so this is something that hasn't gone away. But the Spanish who thought for a long time that sin was involved in this were sometimes confused about whose sins exactly it was that were causing the storms. They sometimes thought it was the sins of the Indians, because they didn't know the true word of God. Later on, after the Spanish had settled, they thought that it was their own sins that had had caused the storms. So that was always kind of up for grabs. But there was something curious about the hurricanes that was different than earthquakes or volcanoes. And it's that the hurricanes, the Spanish learned, only came at a certain time of the year. So if these were punishments from God, it struck them that why was God waiting always till June before he sent the punishments? So the hurricanes, I think, are very interesting in the history of natural disasters because they begin to make people think that maybe there's something else involved in this other than simply the punishment from God, a punishment from God, because of their frequency and their regularity. And their limited time span, they happen basically between June and the end of October, it made people begin to wonder and also to begin to question. And by the middle of the 17th century, people are pretty sure that these are natural phenomena. And although there's a belief that natural phenomena are part of God's greater plan, there begins to be some doubt about whether these are directly punishments from God.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Stuart Schwartz. He is the author of Sea of Storms, A History of Hurricanes in the Greater Caribbean from Columbus to Katrina. So in the 18th century, the Caribbean was transformed by the African slave trade and the expansion of the sugar economy. How would you describe that period in the Caribbean, and how should we understand the forms that the state took during those times and how those entities dealt with the devastation of hurricanes?
So the early settlement of the Caribbean by the Spanish was done as a sort of with government support. But by the 1620s and 30s, the other European nations also begin to acquire territory in the Caribbean region. And, of course, in the United States as what becomes the United States as well. These early settlements, most of them were done by private initiative. The crown would give somebody a grant to settle, but the inputs came from either companies or from private individuals who began these settlements. And the first settlements usually were small farmers. But then, as sugar cane was introduced, we began to get plantations developing. And the plantations then, depending on a labor force, sometimes indentured servants, but pretty quickly changing to enslavement of Africans and bringing over Africans. And we begin to get the kind of typical sugar plantations that we associate with places like Jamaica and Barbados or the French islands of Guadeloupe and Martinique. Well, the storm, they learned relatively quickly about the storms, and the storms sometimes were very destructive, but the proprietors of these islands or the companies that owned these islands didn't think that that the destruction was their responsibility. That was the responsibility of the individuals who owned the plantations, not necessarily of the governing bodies on the plantations. And so the first reaction or responses to these natural disasters like hurricanes was basically a charitable response. This was a matter for the church or for the community to raise monies for relief, or for the individual simply to deal with this as a part of the dangers of doing business in the Caribbean. And that was basically the attitude of most of the European governments for a long time, really until the middle to end of the 18th century. The Spanish were a little bit different, since from the very beginning they had a sort of governmental interest in the colonization. And so what the Spanish government often did after a hurricane was give people tax relief. In other words, the planters didn't have to pay their taxes that particular year as a way of offering them some help, or sometimes providing for materials for rebuilding. The crown would sometimes do that. But the Spanish were somewhat unlike the other European nations. And it's really not till the middle or end of the 18th century that that attitude begins to change.
There's a fair amount of sociological literature pointing to how so-called natural disasters often bring people together, at least for a time. Yet the societies of the Greater Caribbean, during this the period that you're describing, and obviously right up to the present, have been characterized by very pronounced racial and class divisions. So during the period that you're describing, when hurricanes hit, there were some visions that it might pull people together in some way. To what degree was that actually borne out in reality?
Your question is very good, because what happens is once you create these plantation economies on in the Caribbean, many of the Caribbean islands have a structure that's really pretty peculiar. The islands, for example, of the British Caribbean, like Barbados and Jamaica, and some of their smaller islands, are 85% of them, 85% of the population is enslaved, right? You have 15% of the population free, 85% of the population is enslaved. And so when a hurricane comes, rather than creating a sense of community, then what it does is it reveals the hierarchical divisions in the society. Many times after a hurricane, governors would say, well, we all have to get together and rebuild the society. But the slaves, what interest do they have in rebuilding a society in which they're the ones that are enslaved? And so what the fear was in these plantation economies in the Greater Caribbean, the first thing that was feared was that the breakdown of order caused by the disaster would allow the slaves to rise in rebellion. So the first order of business of the governments was to call out the troops or the constabulary to make sure that the slaves would not rise in rebellion, take advantage of the disorder to break their shackles. That was number one. Number two, these colonies existed to produce a profit for the mother countries, England or France or Holland or Denmark. And that profit was generated by the sugar plantations. So the first things the governments wanted to do was to reestablish the plantations, get them back into working order, which meant get the slaves back to work, rebuild the plantation, and get them to produce sugar again, because it was from the taxes of the sugar that the colonies were supported. So the governments begin to take an interest when there's sugar involved, both to reestablish order and to put the plantations back to work. Now, the governors often, after one of these disasters, would call on people to join together to reestablish order, confront the hurricane as a community. And sometimes those efforts were successful. What you could talk about a kind of pan-Caribbean community that develops out of the hurricanes. That is, the French and the English were often at war with each other, but in the islands, after a hurricane struck the British Islands and the French Islands at the same time, those places sometimes collaborated with each other, sent food to each other, materials to each other. And in fact, there's a famous case during the period of the American Revolution where the French governor of Martinique receives a bunch of British sailors whose ships have been destroyed. And rather than hold them as captives, he sends them back with a message that before a natural disaster like a hurricane, we're all in the same boat, and therefore I can't take advantage of these men and make them prisoners. So it did create a kind of sense of Caribbean unity as a result of these natural disasters.
Right, so more at the level of elites and their vision of where they stood.
Right. You know, hurricanes, even today, the countries that are the poorest and the peoples that are the poorest in any country are always the ones most affected by a natural disaster. That's still the case today, as sociologists tell us. And that was true in these colonial societies, too. And so, although the governments were worried about slave rebellions, the truth of the matter was that in most cases, the slaves were the ones who were most in peril when a hurricane came. They had the least sturdy houses. They had the least access to food resources. And so after a hurricane, they were mostly busy trying to survive rather than planning to rebel. And that is just kind of a general principle that extends long past the period of abolition.
So you're arguing that hurricanes played a pretty important role, in a sense, in the formation of these states in the Greater Caribbean, and the fear that the states had, as you just mentioned, that they might lose control of societies in the wake of natural disasters. How were those concerns transformed in the post-emancipation period? Because obviously a population that is enslaved is going to be different than a population that isn't.
So let me answer that in kind of in two parts. The first part is that in fact the major change in governments came around the year 1780, and that year specifically, because in that year the Caribbean was battered by at least five hurricanes. Three of them were simultaneous, and one of them is called the Great Hurricane. It kind of came in across the Atlantic, hit Barbados, and then swung right up the chain of the Lesser Antilles Islands, right up the chain of the islands. And it was at a moment, this is during the American Revolution, when the Caribbean was full of ships and men from France and England and Spain, all tied into the war that was going on at the time. One of these hurricanes, the Great Hurricane, caught a British fleet and then hit the French islands and hit a French fleet. And the result was 30,000 people died as a result of this one hurricane. Barbados was destroyed. And then at the same time, there was yet another hurricane that hit Jamaica. Well, those islands were so battered that the British Parliament, for the first time, voted to send a large amount of money for the relief of those islands. And the reason for it was that because of the war that was going on in the colonial North America, that is the American Revolution, the British government was afraid that these islands might join with the rebels in North America if the government didn't do something for them. So in fact, the first government response on a large scale to hurricanes was in part driven by the political consideration that these places might join in with the rebels in the United States. It was probably an exaggeration by Parliament, because the sugar planters in Barbados and Jamaica, they needed the British Crown and the British Navy. They weren't going to join in the rebellion. But nevertheless, the Parliament went worried enough about it to do that. It's just about that same period that the French also begin to give direct aid to their colonies as a result of these natural disasters. So the government, the hurricanes really begin to bring about a change in government attitudes towards natural disasters. After abolition, which comes in the British Caribbean in 1834 and in the French Caribbean about 1848, what happens is the residue of slavery leaves that the majority of the population are the descendants of the slaves after emancipation. And the attitudes of the governors are often much like the former attitudes towards slaves. You can't give these people something for nothing. If you do, they won't work. And this, of course, was the way in which colonial societies and elites thought about lots of peasant populations. You can find the same kind of language in the British attitudes towards the Irish potato famine, or in British attitudes towards disasters in India or Africa, the same idea. You can't give them charity because then they won't go to work. They're lazy. They're inherently lazy, etc. And we can find lots of evidence of that in the Caribbean, of governors in places like the British Virgin Islands or Jamaica, who simply refused to extend much help to the population because they don't believe that the population is capable of using that help wisely. And so often when help is given, it's usually given to the elites. And then people have to get some relief from the government by getting a job with the plantation or with some other industry. But the help goes to the owner, not to the worker.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the author of Sea of Storms, A History of Hurricanes in the Greater Caribbean from Columbus to Katrina. His name is Stuart Schwartz. He is professor of history at Yale University. One of the things that had a great deal of influence on how governments in the Greater Caribbean dealt with hurricanes in the 19th century was the rise of the United States as an imperial force. Now, of course, you're including the United States in the Greater Caribbean, or at least the southeastern United States. Tell us why the U.S. played such an important hegemonic role, if you will, in influencing the response to hurricanes and then the sort of social ramifications of those decisions.
Yeah. Well, of course, we got directly involved in the Caribbean in the 19th century. That is, with the Monroe Doctrine, became interested in Latin America in 1823. And then during the American Civil War, we were interested in maybe expanding slavery in the period of the 1850s. There were people in the South who thought that the future of slavery would depend on expanding the slave owning economies in places like Cuba and Puerto Rico and of course Brazil was a slave owning country as well. And then in the American Civil War, the South thought perhaps of expanding into the Caribbean. And in the 1860s, the United States even tried to buy, right after the Civil War, tried to buy the Virgin Islands from Denmark. It fell through because of a hurricane in 1867. Nevertheless, we had our eye there. But, of course, the real attachment of the United States into the Caribbean comes in 1898 with the Spanish-American War and the U.S. invasion of Cuba and Puerto Rico. And so we get involved in the Caribbean, and in fact, we take over Puerto Rico in 1898, and while we're occupying Puerto Rico, it's hit by an enormous hurricane, the worst in the history of Puerto Rico. It's called the San Ciriaco Hurricane of 1899. It takes place in August of 1899, and the island is just devastated. Thousands of people are killed, but the island's under U.S. military occupation, and we take this as a moment to demonstrate to the Puerto Ricans the advantage of being under the control of a progressive power, unlike Spain. And so we mounted an enormous relief effort under the American military government. But this relief effort was once again influenced by attitudes. We thought these people weren't capable of taking care of themselves. And we distributed the money to the planters in order to make sure that the money got into the hands of poor people so long as they were working. Right after this hurricane in 1899, the United States itself is struck by a tremendous hurricane, maybe the worst natural disaster in our history before Katrina, and that's the Galveston hurricane of 1900. The city of Galveston, Texas, was completely destroyed by a hurricane. And much of the attitude in the recovery of the Galveston hurricane once again reflects the social attitudes and political attitudes of the time. The recovery effort made in Galveston reported that gangs of blacks were wandering through the streets and cutting the ring fingers off of people, etc. It was all made up at the time, and much exaggerated and circulated through a sort of yellow press in the United States. The National Guard was sent in, and in fact, African Americans were rounded up and held in areas and could not get out until they were employed. Either women as domestics in households or men were taken and put at bayonet point to gather the bodies in Galveston. And so you can see this kind of heritage of the greater Caribbean extended to the southern United States as well. This is not a surprise to what was going on in the south of the United States at the turn of the century. And so the United States is very much part of the story and belongs within this story of the greater Caribbean. But as the United States was emerging as a dominant power after 1898, as the United States was emerging as a power in world politics, the United States also became a model for other Caribbean nations at the time. And so there was cooperation, advice was given, and parallel to this political story is the story of the development of meteorology. The use of the telegraph is kind of dates from the time of the Civil War, and by the 1880s and 90s, there have been scientific developments. The barometer and thermometer are now well into use. The telegraph has arrived, and soon radio communications and progress of technology involves. Some of the best meteorologists of this time are, in fact, in the Hispanic Caribbean. There's a Spanish Jesuit priest named Father Viñes who becomes the director of the Meteorological Observatory in Havana, Cuba, and becomes the world's greatest expert on hurricanes. And in fact, he and his staff try to warn Galveston that the hurricane is coming, and the U.S. Weather Bureau, which had just been set up at this time, wants to have exclusive control over giving that kind of information out, and they prohibit the announcement that coming from Cuba. And in fact, the Galveston meteorologists get it wrong, and that's part of the reason for the disaster in Galveston.
I wonder if you could talk about how the attitudes towards hurricanes, and particularly attitudes towards protecting societies from hurricanes, trying to deal with the devastation once hurricanes hit, how that shifts when there is an ideological and economic shift from the mid-20th century to the late 20th century that might be characterized as populist governments being replaced by those dominated by the neoliberal ideology of the free market.
So, again, so the place to start, I think, is around the time of the Depression. With the crisis of 1929 and the beginning of the Depression, all of these countries in the Caribbean and the United States went into a period of economic hardship. In some places in the Caribbean, like the Dominican Republic, the crisis caused a change in the politics, and people like General Trujillo takes over in the Dominican Republic as a dictator. In the United States, we have the coming of the 1930 Roosevelt's election in the 30s, and the coming of the New Deal is one of the responses. But this period between roughly 1926 and 1935 is a very intense period of hurricanes in the United States and in the Caribbean. And so it's a kind of response of governments to natural disaster. But this argument by the 1930s that's made in the creation of the New Deal is that a economic crisis like the stock market crash and what it creates has the same effect on people as does a natural disaster. And that we ought to do for people in normal hard times the same thing we do in extraordinary hard times, the ones that are created by natural disasters. If you look at the speeches of Senator La Follette from Wisconsin, was kind of one of the architects of the New Deal, you can see he repeats over and over again, we should be doing for people in the New Deal what we do for people recovering from natural disasters like the Mississippi floods or like hurricanes like the 1926 or 1928 Florida hurricanes. And so the idea of that the New Deal the welfare state grows out of the attitudes toward this disaster relief has been taken up by a number of scholars here in the United States, and it applies to other places in the Americas as well. And so by the 1950s and 60s, we have various institutions that are created to respond to natural disasters. And the attitude of the government, of governments, is that the government needs to respond. Part of this grows out of the 1930s and a kind of populism that you can see in Roosevelt, but you can also see it in Cuba and in the Dominican Republic and elsewhere in the Americas. And you can see it, of course, in other places in the world. So the idea that that the people look to the government for help and the government feels a sense of responsibility to its citizens. This, in fact, the League of Nations in the 1920s had begun to talk about disaster relief, not as a privilege, but as something that people were entitled to as citizens of the country, since it was for the common good. And the idea that the American Congress should act only in the common good was increasingly by the 1950s and 60s applied to this kind of disaster relief. But in the United States, there had always been a line of thought that was not the government's responsibility. That was the responsibility of states or of charitable institutions, private charities. And that debate continued on into the period of the 1950s and the 60s. And today, the debates that we have now when there's a natural disaster are basically echoes of that same debate that was already taking place in the 1920s and 30s about who is responsible for a natural disaster, the federal government, the state government, or the communities and local institutions.
Stuart Schwartz is my guest. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and he is a historian. He teaches at Yale University and author of the new book, Sea of Storms, A History of Hurricanes in the Greater Caribbean from Columbus to Katrina. Hurricane Katrina hit in 2005, and I wonder if you can explain why the experience of Hurricane Katrina in some ways really epitomizes the concentration of so many of the different forces that you trace both over time and in the region of the Greater Caribbean in your book, socially, ideologically, and so on.
Well, Hurricane Katrina, of course, was a tremendous disaster. 1,883 people killed and $125 billion worth of damage. I think that it focused attention, those images that we saw of the people on the rooftops and of the people gathered together in the football stadium in New Orleans without food or adequate food or water resources and there for 10 or 12 days before relief began to come, I think really focused attention, those images of New Orleans as a kind of a third world country, really brought to the surface the tensions that existed about whose responsibility was this. If you think that the federal government really isn't responsible, or that the federal government should have devoted its resources to other kinds of security, this was possibly the kind of the answer to that position as a sort of result. The FEMA existed, but FEMA, because of the the 9/11 attack, the shift of focus had been to other kinds of security issues, not to natural disasters, but to terrorism. And there were all kinds of questions about whether FEMA was being adequately funded, whether it was being staffed by the right people, or whether it had become a kind of sinecure for supporters of the administration. Many of the things that take place in the governmental attitudes and in the state attitude after Katrina reflect the long history of the hurricanes. The attitudes that the people who had not evacuated were responsible for their own dilemma was echoed by a number of politicians in the United States at the time. Now, we know now that what happened was that there had been plans for hurricane evacuation, but that the plans had not gone far enough, and that the planners knew that there was a large number of people in New Orleans, poor people, who didn't have the transportation or access to transportation to get themselves out in case of a hurricane emergency. And there wasn't adequate transportation to get them out. When the hurricane took place and bus drivers from other communities in Louisiana and from surrounding states tried to get to New Orleans and volunteer, many were turned away because the buses didn't have bathrooms on them or because people didn't have state licenses. In fact, they turned away medical workers because they weren't licensed in the state of Louisiana. Those were the kinds of snafus that took place that revealed the lack of planning that had really gone on, and the way in which the state government was unprepared for the municipal and state government was unprepared for disaster, just as the national government had been unprepared for it. And so what Katrina did is it revealed a lot of the shortcomings of preparation and the shortcomings of the philosophy of how to respond to natural disasters and whose responsibility it really is. If you believe that government is too big, and you need to cut the resources that go into the government, then basically you remove the ability of government to supply the infrastructure in a case of a natural disaster. And so if you don't have enough buses or you don't have enough helicopters, then this is what it produces. And Katrina was kind of a sort of a model of some of the things that could go wrong by underfunding government institutions or the ability of the government to respond to the natural disasters.
And that was Stuart Schwartz, historian and author of Sea of Storms, The History of Hurricanes in the Greater Caribbean from Columbus to Katrina. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We now turn to a conversation I had with Dale Jamieson, professor of environmental studies and philosophy at New York University, when his book Reason in a Dark Time came out. I asked him if the immensity of global warming had been a hindrance in addressing it.
Yeah, and I have to say, to some extent, I think that's there's been a kind of conscious strategy that also has sort of piggybacked on the ways that we naturally think about this problem. So the denial strategy, in part, is about denying the existence of the problem until it's too late to do anything about it. So there's a kind of polarity that works for people who don't want to act on this problem, which is to deny, 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 and then say, we can't do anything about it. It's now a fait accompli. And I think it's been a very successful strategy in many ways. And it is a very difficult issue for me to address in my book, because on the one hand, I think we need to be honest and say, we have committed the world to 1,000 years of climate change. That's a fact. We have to accept it. There's no preventing climate change. But that doesn't mean that there's nothing we can do. It matters that we slow it down and limit its extent, and it matters how we adapt to it. So there's still things we can do, even though we've lost the fundamental struggle.
One of the things that I think has influenced some people's perspective about climate change in terms of a kind of overwhelming pessimism has to do with a notion of tipping points, that there are these thresholds that get crossed, and after that, there are processes set in motion that can't be reversed. Where does this notion of tipping points come from, and how backed up by science is it, and is it useful?
So it's interesting, because we do know that there are tipping points. There are tipping points in nature. There are tipping points in social life. But if you just do a sort of Google search on the term tipping points, what you discover is that a whole lot of them seem to come into existence after the publication of Malcolm Gladwell's book, Tipping Points. It's something that we became very aware of as a society and as a culture at a particular datable point in time. Now, when it comes to the climate system, there's no doubt that, as with other complex systems, there are tipping points. It's just that we don't really know exactly where they are and exactly how they function. And I actually think that the rhetoric of tipping point is often not been a very useful rhetoric in the way that we think about climate change. Part of the problem with the tipping point rhetoric is it becomes, again, this all-or-nothing thing. As long as we don't cross some tipping point or cross some line, then everything is okay. If we cross the line, then everything is lost. Now, there probably are those tipping points, though we don't know where they are. But more importantly, it's better to have less emissions than more emissions, both because it will reduce our chances of reaching a tipping point, but also because it'll make the change more manageable. So, you know, I would rather see us just focus on the hard slog that is this problem, rather than focus on the kind of catastrophic scenario.
That was an excerpt of a conversation I had with Dale Jamieson, professor of environmental studies and philosophy at New York University and author of Reason in a Dark Time. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.